Hello and welcome to After the Collapse, a show dedicated to the link between economic exploitation and social injustice. I'm Louis Maroney. I'm here with Jim Vernon, as always, and you're listening to Radio Regent. I should note that we've been at a cafe in the Rustic Owl, so you've been hearing some ambient noise in the background. December 31st has been a date looming for Ontario public school boards since the Ontario government passed Bill 115, or the Putting Students First Act, on September 11th. By December 31st, all collective bargaining agreements must be signed and sealed and must follow the restrictions outlined in the Act. These restrictions include a two-year pay freeze for teachers, restrictions on the number of sick days, the elimination of compensation for unused sick days upon retirement, and the inability to strike in protest. All of this to protect through fiscal restraints what the government has pointed to as significant improvements in the Ontario education system, including smaller class sizes, increase to the number of teachers, and full-time daycare. For teachers, Bill 115 represents the trampling of their fundamental constitutional right to negotiate their contracts freely within the rule of law. In their latest response, teachers have announced that they will take job action as of November 7th. Here to help us navigate this issue from the perspective of teachers is Laura McCoy. Laura McCoy is a teacher in downtown Toronto and a union steward for the Elementary Teachers of Toronto. She has been teaching in Toronto for 15 years, and she has two school-aged children who greatly benefit from a strong public school system and who remind her that it's worth fighting for. Thank you, Laura, and welcome.
Thank you.
So we thought we'd have you start with giving us some background as how we got to Bill 115.
Okay. If we look back to early winter and McGuinty's efforts to reduce the deficit, we can see the Drummond Report, which I think is sort of an important starting point in our negotiations. In February, it was released, and it's a report which recommends cutting various programs, and there's a section dedicated to education. And in it, he outlines funding cuts, which he thinks the provincial government should implement, like limiting educational spending to 1%, increasing primary class sizes, 25% reduction in capital renewal, so that's funding for building projects in schools, and canceling the teachers' retirement gratuities. And I think this was an important point in the provincial government funding that led to the idea then that they would implement contracts for teachers that cut a lot of the funding. So our contracts are actually negotiated provincially and at local levels. Each school board does their own contracts. But in the last couple of years, the ministry has had a great impact. Rather than just letting teachers negotiate their contracts locally with their school boards, they've put together a group of people from the Ministry of Education and from teachers' unions and from school boards who come up with what they call a provincial table, a provincial discussion table agreement, and so that sets the monetary provisions for teachers' contracts. So teachers' salaries and things like that get decided actually at a provincial level, and that way they are the same all across the province, even though local school boards actually sign their own contracts. So what happened this year was that because they were looking for all these cuts financially, they put together a PDT agreement, which is what we call that, and it basically relied on the Drummond Report for its financial parameters. And then they called the unions to the table to look at this agreement that they had put forth. And although they called it negotiations, it really wasn't negotiations. It was a, here's what we're going to give you, and we're not going to hand over any money for anything else. So it's a bit of a take-it-or-leave-it deal. The unions sat in on a little bit of negotiations, but very quickly ETFO, which is the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario, and OSSTF, which is the secondary schools, left those discussions because they realized it wasn't actually negotiations. It was the government saying, okay, we're going to cut your funding and there's nothing you can do about it. OECTA, which is the Catholic teachers, actually did stay at the discussions for a longer period of time, and then in the summer they did come up with an agreement, which was basically the government's cuts, and they accepted it. OECTA historically has been a weaker union. It's a smaller union. They have already in the past given up a lot, so they weren't feeling like this was going to be a lot of cuts for them, whereas it would be a lot of cuts for ETFO and OSSTF. So anyway, OECTA took the agreement, and for the provincial government then, that was a sign that they could force that agreement on the rest of the teachers' unions. The other teachers' unions weren't willing to take it, so they wrote it up as a bill, Bill 115, and they do call it the Putting Students First Act.
Families first.
So it's really interesting how they phrase that. I mean, they really want to be seen as the education government, putting students first, putting families first. But it's so much just about cutting finances. And in fact, the real name of the bill is an act to implement restraint measures in the education sector, which never gets published. So they put forth that bill, and I think in a fairly cynical move, they put it out in the summer, of course, when teachers are not working. We had early on voted that we would walk out of work for a day if they put a bill forth to implement a contract to us, but then they did it in the summer, of course, so we weren't working. The other thing I think that is important is the fact that they were a minority government, and there were by-elections coming in the fall, and I think it was a bit of a ploy to get people to support them, as they are seen to sort of be putting teachers in their place. Like, I think teachers are a bit of an easy target. So those two things came together, the desire to cut financially and in the hopes that they would win by elections, which they didn't win the one in Kitchener. So
there's a bit of an irony there with the putting students first.
Yeah.
But doing that by imposing restrictions on the people that are responsible for educating those
students. Yeah, I think it's I don't really understand how they can do that, but they seem to feel like they could manipulate the public into thinking that teachers are greedy and not very good, but at the same time they are putting the students first and not really bringing those two things together, that we need good, strong teachers in order to make the education system work. And I think we have good, strong teachers. And I think if you look at societies, like Finland, which is being sort of much touted in the news these days as having the best educational system in the world, they have teachers who are really well educated and really respected. It's not necessarily that they're super highly paid. It's not necessarily a pay issue, but it's an issue of respect and giving them autonomy, that the teachers there get to make a lot of their own decisions about what they teach and how they teach it. And the students turn out really, really, they do really, really well on any international test. And I think that's a little bit what's missing here, is that the provincial government talks about putting students first, but they don't actually follow through with any actions. And more and more teachers are asked to do standardized testing and the standardized report card and make do with less, you know, cutting in the classroom, bigger class sizes, really. Like, I've not seen any decrease in class sizes and all those kinds of things, and the teachers are really feeling a disrespect. So I think that's kind of where we are.
The government is saying, and sorry, Jim, I know we've got a follow-up question here, but just to stick on Bill 15, mm-hmm. 115 for a second, mm-hmm. the government is saying that they have implemented things to this date that have actually improved the education system, i.e., smaller class sizes, the full-day kindergarten, and that they've hired more teachers, that they've hired more staff, and in order to maintain, and that because of that, they've actually improved the education system, that students are getting higher grades, the graduation rates are higher, and because of that, they need to impose these restrictions in order to be able to afford to continue to do this.
Yes.
And I think in reading through the material, that mm-hmm. that's where the economics or the money of mm-hmm. it comes into the line is being drawn down the money line.
Yeah.
And they say the only place where they can find savings is by cutting back on the exorbitant cost of human resources,
right? Teacher salaries.
So
yeah, and I think teacher salaries are not the necessarily the biggest expenditure, and I think that in terms of the union negotiations, teacher salaries are not even where our biggest fight is. I mean, a lot of the teacher unions have said that they're perfectly happy to take a wage freeze.
For 2 years, yeah.
Part of the agreement also has 3 unpaid days, so it is, in fact, a 1.5% wage cut. And those are not our biggest fights. I think if you look at the things that they say they've implemented, that the Liberal government says they've implemented, they're, I think they're being a little... not entirely truthful. So, for example, the class size caps. So primary grades 1 to 3, do have a cap of 20, although then there are exceptions. So a lot of primary class sizes, in fact, have more than 20. They might have up to 23. And that's only grades 1, 2, and 3. So grade 4 to 8 and high schools have no caps. So in my school, for example, last year we had grade 8 classes with 32 and 33 students in them. And this year they're slightly smaller with 28, but still 28 grade 8 students is a lot of students in one class with no help, no education assistance or anything like that. And we would have kids, you know, classes might have 6 or 10 kids with special education needs, ESL needs, behavioral concerns, things like that. So those are big classes. And the full-day kindergarten actually has a class cap of 30. And I think that's something that's not widely known, that before the full-day program, it was capped at 20. And then they put it in full day, and they've capped it at 30. And 33, 4, and 5-year-olds in one room, even if you have an ECE worker, is a lot of little kids. I mean, there's kids there who've never been in a full-day program anywhere. And even with 2 adults in the room, I think there's a lot of chaos. And it's not necessarily a really good learning environment for the students. So I like full-day kindergarten. I think that's a program we're supporting. But I think the fact that they're, you know, selling it as this really wonderful, wonderful program is not entirely truthful, that it's there are problems to it. The other thing that the union has pointed at is the EQAO, or the lots of standardized testing that we have, that's a really big expenditure. And if we look at worldwide studies, we will see that increasing standardized tests does nothing to increase the educational results, really, in the end. And again, if we look at Finland, they don't do any standardized testing until the very end of secondary. And their students, when they do the testing, score right at the top. We spend a huge amount of money on preparing for the tests and marking the tests and then gathering statistics from the tests. And I know people who have marked the tests, and I think the gathering of the statistics is a little bit skewed, that it was harder the first year and the tests got easier the second year, so people's marks went up. So I think there's a lot of concerns around the testing, and if they just canceled the test, they would save an awful lot of money.
It's interesting thinking about the testing, because that was one of the issues in Chicago as well.
Yeah, definitely.
And the increase in teaching to test as opposed to teaching to student, mm-hmm. to draw out of the student capacities that are inherent as opposed to pouring in information that will get put in the scan file.
Exactly,
is a fairly common
issue.
Maybe just speaking to that and perhaps some of the other specific conditions imposed by the bill that mm-hmm. the teachers are opposed to, if you can, beyond the wage freeze and the wage cut, in fact, can you specify some of the more objectionable conditions?
Yeah. So one of the things that have gotten people quite... Well, 2 things have gotten people quite frustrated. One is our 6 days, and one is our retirement gratuity. We used to get 20 sick days a year, and they would be cumulative. So year after year, you would save them up. You could bank them.
Which is, far more than I get.
Right. It's more than a lot of people get, and we recognize that. Like, I know my sister is a children's aid social worker, and she got 15. They used to be bankable, and then they're not. So I think that's happening to a lot of people. A lot of people don't get that. I think one of the reasons teachers have gotten those in the past is that they can be used for things like religious holidays. So, of course, in the school system, the Christian holidays are holidays, not going to school days. But if you're of any other religion, your day is a work day. So the sick days can be used for those days, for example. And other days where we don't really have the flexibility because school goes on certain days. You can't just rearrange your schedule. You can't just work from home. Days like conferences or appointments or things like that. So historically, we've bargained for that. I guess there is a recognition that teachers might get sick because of working with so many students in a close setting, that teachers actually do end up with, you know, colds and flus and things like that. The thing that we had with the banking of the sick days and the retirement gratuity was that they could be saved up to the end, and then you would get payout of half up to a maximum of 1 year's salary, but half of that. So the most anybody would get paid out at the end of their career was half of their greatest year of 1 year's salary. And that was made as a cost-saving measure. Most teachers, in fact, don't take 20 sick days in a year. The average, I've heard between 7 and 9. I'm not sure exactly which one, but it's not more than 9. So most teachers don't take advantage of that. And then they save them up at the end, and they do get a small payout, although whatever they don't use for the payout is just lost. So I think if we look at that, I know that it's a benefit that a lot of other people don't have. It's certainly not as great a benefit as, for example, the MPPs, who end up with severance payouts in the $200,000 and $300,000 range at the end of their career. So what I would say in terms of that is that I think it's important that we as teachers recognize that that is a benefit that we've fought for, and that it's a generous benefit in terms of, like, comparing it to, you know, retail workers, for example. And one of the things as a union I think we're trying to do is make this not a race to the bottom. You know, because other people don't have this benefit, we shouldn't just say, okay, well, let's just give up that benefit. What we need to do is make it a bigger political fight and say, well, how can we, you know, unionize more workers or fight for other workers who are not unionized and recognize that they too need sick days and they too need a great salary and benefits and things like that. So I think that's part of our political fight. We don't want to just give up our benefits without a fight, and we want to work at spreading those benefits to other people.
What about the economic climate now, though? I mean, we've mm-hmm. a couple, actually all of our interviews so far, this has come up. It's like, well, the government climate seems to be banking on that, you know, everybody's has to tighten their belt.
Yeah, definitely they're banking on it. And I know, like when we're out demonstrating or leafleting or something, there are always people who come up and say, well, you know, I don't have that, and these are tough economic times, and you need to tighten your belt too. And I think what we need to do is we look at where the money is, because there is money, right? I mean, there's money in the large corporations who don't get taxed the way they should be taxed. There's money in the big banks and things like that. And I think it's a matter of looking at what we value in society and where the money is, and thinking about how do we redistribute that. Like, do we take the money from the corporations in taxation and tax the wealthy people in society and insist that they pay their fair share? Because, I mean, there is money. I know there's money out there, and we need to say, well, we value public education and we value healthcare and, you know, all the work that gets done by all the working people is valuable work, and very few people are benefiting from that. And we need to become a broader movement, I think, where people are not fighting in amongst themselves, that the people who are making minimum wage, for example, and not having benefits and not having 20 sick days, get to be part of the movement. And we as teachers, who are in a privileged position, I know that we are, I know that I have a really decent income, and I know that I have really good benefits, and I need to not just kind of sit on that. I need to say, well, it's not just for me. I need to then become more politically active so that I work with other people and we make a real effort to make a more fair and just society where people all have access to these really good benefits.
And of course, this the corporate tax and the rich with the mm-hmm. you know, the 1% obviously mm-hmm. has been really highlighted with the Occupy movement.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's something that people across issues have cited.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel that your side has how successful has your side been in the messaging battle between yourselves and the government, who would say, well, that's not the issue. The issue is everybody needing to tighten their belt again.
Yeah. Well, I think we're working on it. I feel like right at this moment, the teachers are having some success in terms of getting the message out there. I mean, I think right at this moment in time, I mean, McGuinty resigned, he prorogued the government, that people are looking at him with some skepticism and feeling like maybe he didn't really know what he was doing, and I'm not sure that that gave him a great deal of positive, not a positive message out there. And so I think this is a really big opportunity for us. It's a good time for us to move our politics. I'm not sure we've done it yet, but I think we're kind of moving in that right direction. And I think there are more people within the teachers union who are starting to see this as a bigger fight. It's not just us negotiating our contract right now. I mean, we do need to do that. But at the same time, I think there's enough people, sort of a core group of people, who are seeing this as a potential, a time with potential, that there are political actions that can be made. And I know that teachers are really making an effort to get out in the community. I mean, we have our own community in the schools. Of course, we have the parents and the students who we see on a daily basis, and so we can talk to them. And I think they do tend to be overwhelmingly supportive. But we've also been out in the community meeting people who are not necessarily parents, and really trying to talk to them about changes that can be made. So I think we're having some success, and we're starting to see where we can go with this in terms of politics.
Well, maybe this is a good time to take a short break and play the first song. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could introduce.
Sure.
What you choose for.
Okay. Well, the first song that I will choose is "Chicago Teacher" by Rebel Diaz, and the Chicago Teachers had a strike just earlier in the fall, and I think it was a really interesting teacher's strike, and they did get a fair amount of support, and they resolved their strike with a bit of both sides coming together and kind of trying to work things out, and I think it was a really strong movement for the union. And Rebel Diaz is a group made up of Rodrigo Venegas and Gonzalez Venegas, who were Chicago-raised children of Chilean activists. And they grew up in Chicago and went to the Chicago public schools, and so they wrote this song during the teachers' strike in support of the teachers, and I think it's kind of a really nice song. Really.
Here we go. Come on. Look. Yo. Homie, I was taught by a Chicago teacher. Chicago teacher. Chicago teacher. I learned to read and write from a Chicago teacher, so I'm inspired by the fight from my Chicago teachers. Homie, I was taught by a Chicago teacher. Chicago teacher. Chicago teacher. I learned to read and write from a Chicago teacher, so I'm inspired by the fight from my Chicago teachers. The teachers are tired, the students dumbfounded, the budgets get cut so classes are overcrowded, streets full of violence, the blue coat is silence, so I'ma keep rhyming till salaries start rising, the unions are rising, taking to the streets, the workers are united, so the mayor's got beef, rhymes a fake pretender with a corporate agenda, neoliberal offender, of course you offend us, this ain't about money, that's far from the truth, they want better work conditions to teach the youth, politicians, I don't trust them, it's all in the name, the president, the mayor, all want political gain, they'd rather put the kids in jail, shackle them with chains, and provide an education that challenges the brain, top down education, Chicago the birthplace, now it's spreading nationwide all over the place, they don't teach us how to think, they teach us how to test, they teach us how to work to put money in their checks, the CEOs need to get up out the classroom, before these streets get hotter than the sand in Cancun, so join the picket line like Mr. Pickett in his prime, put on your red shirt like the Bulls in 95, hit the streets with a sign, and say I'm fighting for mine, it's a fork in the road, and you gotta choose a side, and yes I'm proud to say I was a public school student, it was public school teachers that first taught me music, and yes I'm proud to say I was a public school student, a public school teacher first taught me music. Homie, I was taught by a Chicago teacher, Chicago teacher, Chicago teacher. I learned to read and write from a Chicago teacher, so I'm inspired by the fight from my Chicago teachers. Went to Lil Lincoln School in a little school bus, desegregation, pay 20 cents for lunch, reduced price ticket for the lower income children, art and music classes in between math and English. Now it's different, they just teaching to the test, forced by the feds, or they losing that check. Too many children left behind by this corporate assembly line. How they privatize, education is a human right, and they kids gonna be fine, they send them to private schools, while ours get sent to prison or given a job serving fast food, cash rules, so it gets treated like a business, bought and sober. Businessmen turn politicians. So if Rahm was the chief of staff and Arnie Duncan got his start in Chicago selling off the education system, then Obama gotta respond. The teachers or the corporations, when Chief Keef, but it's a million others like them being created every week. If we don't teach, we don't learn, and the streets is gonna burn before it gets worse. I put on my red shirt, cause homie, I was taught by a Chicago teacher. Chicago teacher, Chicago teacher. I learned to read and write from a Chicago teacher, so I'm inspired by the fight for my Chicago teachers. Homie, I was taught by a Chicago teacher. Chicago teacher, Chicago teacher. I learned to read and write from a Chicago teacher, so I'm inspired by the fight for my Chicago teachers. Yeah. Bateman Elementary, where Illinois went. Lincoln School, Lane Tech, Lincoln Park High School. DJ Illinois went to Roosevelt, and now he producing beats worldwide. Let's go.
Okay, welcome back to After the Collapse, a show dedicated to exploring the link between economic exploitation and social injustice. That was a Chicago teacher, and the group is Rebel Diaz. And we're here with Laura McCoy, who is speaking to us today about the current environment surrounding the teachers' union in Ontario and the government of Ontario's passing of Bill 115. So welcome again.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Regent. And Jim, you want me to ask the next question? Okay. So, Laura, because something we haven't talked about with regard to Bill 115 is the right to strike.
Yes.
And the way I understand it, in the context of the specific restrictions that they've put on this within this 2-year period, that is the pay freeze and the retirement
gratuity
and the sick days, those are not issues which you can strike on.
Correct.
Which I'd love to hear your perspective on, because that is almost it seems like an issue outside of everything that we've been talking about.
Yeah, and that's a huge issue. And I think at this point in our negotiations, that is the focus of much of our political action, because in Bill 115, it is written that nothing in the bill can be challenged under the Labor Relations Act or even under the Human Rights Act. And I think that this is, I mean, it's almost unbelievable that they would write a bill with that provision in it. So in terms of the ability to take job action, either work to rule or strike, what it says in the Act is that the Minister of Education, so just one person, can restrict our right to strike. And so what we've done, the teachers, is, well, we've continued on with our negotiations as we would normally do. So we are the negotiations team from the Elementary Teachers of Toronto and from all the other locals in the province are meeting with their school boards as they normally would to continue to negotiate. And they're negotiating non-monetary items, like prep time and supervision time and things like that. So they are meeting. We've all had strike votes. So before, I think it was October 9th, every local in the province conducted a strike vote. There was nothing in Bill 115 that eliminated that possibility. So every local got somewhere probably in the mid-90s, we got Elementary Teachers of Toronto got 96% support of strike action. So what our plan is that we would kind of progress, continue on as we would normally do until somebody says stop. So at this point in time, we have a strike mandate and a conciliator has been called in, and so the next step would be to issue a no board report, and then we will be in a legal strike position. So our feeling with regards to the fact that it says that we are not legally allowed to strike in the bill is that we're going to make her stand up and say, no, you can't do it. And so that's one aspect of it, is we will continue on. The other aspect of it, of course, is that we've challenged this in court, because we don't really believe that it is constitutional that you can do that. We do have Labor Relations Act, and we do have a Human Rights Act. We've launched a court challenge. All of the different locals and QP and various other educational groups have entered court challenges. And I mean, it's tricky, but we really feel that this will be successful. The BC teachers had a similar court challenge, and they did win it last year. The problem, of course, is that these things take a long, long period of time. So I think that's one of the really, really big issues in Bill 115, and that's something that we really want to publicize to people, that it's not just about taking away our sick days or cutting our salary. It's the fact that the government felt that they could implement a bill that put itself above labor relations and above human rights, and that takes a lot of gall, really.
Yeah, and obviously, too, if they're successful, it creates a precedence,
yes,
which has implications for not just teachers.
Yeah, very much so. And of course, just before McGuinty prorogued the government, he had other stuff in the works which would impose very similar restrictions on all the other public sector unions. And that, I guess, got shelved with the proroguing of the government. But it's a really scary thought that they could just implement whatever they want and say to people, okay, you can't negotiate, okay, you can't challenge this bill, we're just going to do whatever we want to do. And that's, I mean, it's certainly not democratic, and it's not the way we should govern. It's beyond ridiculous.
It's interesting thinking about it in the context of recent efforts on behalf of the federal and provincial conservatives to float right-to-work legislation, where you can work in the public and private sector without paying unions, therefore starving the unions, but operating at the same level of pay.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if the teachers' unions are in particular worried about the ever-encroaching movement against the very idea of unionization.
Yes.
As we saw in Wisconsin and other places.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there is definitely a worry about that. We have a fairly strong union, and we do have a large membership. And it feels like the general feeling in our union here in Toronto is very supportive. I think that the union membership is very strong, but I'm not sure it has the strength everywhere. So I think that is definitely a worry. And if we look at where we might be going provincially, definitely there is the worry that if the Conservatives came to power, that that kind of legislation might be considered, right? I mean, I think that's one reason we have to, of course, be politically active in any future election, is that we can't be complacent, and we have to think carefully about where our support is. And I think that's actually been a bit of a mistake on the part of the teachers' unions, is they've supported the Liberal Party almost without question. And I think that at this point we do really need to question that look at, look at the NDP, or look at what other options we have in terms of provincial government. And also to really try to expand our union base, and I think, you know, it has been shrinking, not just teachers, but unions in general, and that we really need to look at making inroads into other sectors, that we need to work at unionizing the Walmart workers and the McDonald's workers and the cleaning staff, and that any union now, one of its mandates needs to be to try to expand the union movement.
How is the teachers' union's communication relationship with other existing unions outside of the education system?
My sense is that it's pretty good. Like, I know, for example, CUPE and the education and the teachers' unions work very closely together, because a lot of CUPE workers work in schools. There are definitely CUPE workers in schools. So I think that there's a really strong connection between education workers, so teachers and non-teaching education staff. I think there's connection between, CAW and various unions like that. But I think probably what we need to work on are the unions that are not directly connected to schools. Like, we work with the unions that are in the schools very closely, and we work with other unions also, but maybe that's an area that could be strengthened.
And how as you as mm-hmm. an individual, yeah. you're both a teacher and you're also a union steward.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go about trying to affect that change, having that opinion?
Well, a couple of things, I guess, is I try to communicate information to the other teachers in the school and to just get the get people's ideas going that they need to be supportive of other union movements. So, if, for example, if there was a strike or a political protest or something by other unions, that's something that we as teachers can support. So we would go and picket or whatever, that kind of thing. And as a steward, then there are opportunities to get involved in various committees at the union level, which would also go out and support other unions. I think that's something maybe that could be developed more, though. You know, that's an area where, I mean, I myself haven't really been that involved.
Mm-hmm.
But I think just sort of in discussions with union executive, that is an area that we really want to expand, is having the local teachers, just ordinary everyday teachers, become more involved in connecting with other unions and other workers.
And you are a teacher, and so you're dealing with other teachers all the
mm-hmm.
time, and you're trying to encourage them with regard to your work with the union.
Yeah.
How, and you've already noted within your union there is 96% in favor of a strike action.
Yeah.
How easy or difficult would it be to, if you were given the mandate,
yeah.
to have teachers get more involved, given people's lives,
mm-hmm.
also given the environment? Do you
yeah.
feel that there's a desire, if the opportunity was given, that they would step up and be more involved?
Yeah, I think they would be. I think teachers feel, there's a lot of feeling of overwork. The teachers are tired, and a lot is asked of us in our regular job, more and more when we think about the standardized test and the report card and stuff like that. It's become sort of paperwork heavy in a sense, so teachers are feeling a little bit tired. But I have seen that teachers are stepping up, and so, for example, we do a Friday afternoon picket at MPP's office, and we've been doing that for about a month and a half now, and I've been pleasantly surprised that a lot of the teachers at my school do come out on a regular basis, and other schools in the neighborhood. And there are teachers there who said to me, you know, that before this they had never been to a demonstration, they had never held a picket sign, they had never done anything politically motivated, and now they are. And I think that they are seeing that, you know, because it's hitting close to home, they feel this need to go out and make their voices heard. And they've also then realized that this is not just about the teachers, but that it is a wider struggle. So I feel like teachers are becoming more aware, and when I go to the stewards meetings and people talk about what's going on there in their schools, we do really see a feeling of solidarity and teachers doing actions that they might not have done before, you know, leafleting and going around the community and meeting community members and talking about what our struggle is. There's a political action committee within the union that does sort of, you know, political theater. There was a funeral for collective bargaining, for example. And so I think these actions are happening, and it's kind of a continuous education that's needed of the teachers to get them more involved. But I feel like it's a good time and that people are becoming more and more involved.
There's a bit of momentum.
There's momentum, absolutely, mm-hmm. yes.
On that note, we should play a union song.
Okay. So another song that I've picked is Anita Franco singing Which Side Are You On, which is, again, a pretty famous union song that's been recorded by a number of people, Billy Bragg, Pete Seeger. Pete Seeger, I think, made it famous initially. It was written by Florence Reese, who was the wife of a miner, a union organizer in the 30s. So here's Anita Franco.
Still, we the people won. We voted out corruption, big corporations. We voted for an end to war, new direction. And we ain't gonna stop now till the job is done. Come on, all good workers, this year is our time. Now there's folks in Washington care what's on our minds. Come on, come on, voters, let's all vote next time. Show them which side are you on now, which side are you on?
Okay, so welcome back to After the Collapse. This is a show dedicated to exploring the link between economic exploitation and social injustice. I'm Louis Moroni, and I'm here with Jim Vernon, my partner, and on the radio, and Laura McCoy, who is a union steward for the Elementary Teachers of Toronto. And we've been talking about, obviously, the current state of affairs between the Ontario teachers and the Ontario Liberal government, specifically the impending deadline of December 31st, at which point all collective bargaining agreements need to be signed in the context of Bill 115, which imposes various restrictions on the teachers' salaries over the next 2 years, as well as the their retirement
gratuities,
thank you again, and sick days, as well as restrictions on their right to strike on the basis of any of those points. Jim.
So we've been talking a bit about community outreach and consciousness raising. I wonder if we could now talk about the specific job actions being taken to fight back.
Right. So the job actions that we've been taking from the beginning of the school year include taking a pause, and that's sort of how we've been phrasing it in the school. So what teachers do in school is outlined in the Education Act and in our collective agreements, and there are certain jobs that we are required to do as teachers, and then there are other jobs that we do because we know that it benefits the students and it makes the school a really exciting and fun place to be. And there are other things that we do that we are required to do as part of our job, but we're not necessarily given time during the day to do, like, write report cards or IEPs, which are individual education plans and things like that. So what we've been doing since the beginning of the year is considering which of those activities are absolutely necessary and which are actually part of our jobs, and making our own personal decisions about where we can pause. So for a lot of teachers, that has meant cutting back on the extracurricular activities and not going to unnecessary meetings and things like that. I know that it's been quite publicized about the lack of extracurricular activities, and that is something the teachers consider very seriously and don't make a decision about lightly. But because of the nature of our job, we don't really have that many avenues when we pull back a little bit. And it is a voluntary thing. There is nothing in the Education Act or in our collective agreement that says that we have to coach a soccer team, for example, or work on the yearbook. So one of the points we would like to make to the public is that we spend a lot of our own time working on those things. So I teach during the day, and part of my teaching job is preparing for teaching and supervising the students and teaching and then marking and then, you know, going to a certain number of meetings and writing individual education plans. But being the yearbook coordinator or the art club supervisor is not actually part of my job. I do those things because I really like to do those things, but they are done on my own time.
It's actually phenomenal that, again, putting students first, mm-hmm. Extracurricular activities, I'm going to go out on a limb and say mm-hmm. that they are an integral part of your education.
They are,
and
absolutely.
And yet, there's actually nothing written in the agreement that guarantees students access to that.
No, there isn't. And so teachers do that because we like to do them, and we really see how they benefit students, no question about that. But the fact is they all add on time to our duties and to our days. And so what we've done is pulled back a little bit from that just to get people to acknowledge that those are voluntary activities. And also just to consider the fact that we are, you know, we're losing sick days and we're losing wages, and maybe we don't actually have time in our days to fit all of those things in that are above and beyond our job. So that's what our pause is about, considering our voluntary commitments. The other thing we've been working at is the McGinty Mondays. So elementary teachers and secondary teachers, but I think this was put forth by the elementary teachers, implemented McGinty Mondays. And so on Mondays in particular, we are basically, it works out to working to rules. So we go in, the Education Act says that we need to be in the schools 15 minutes before school starts. We've been going in not earlier than half an hour before school starts. And anybody who teaches for a full day knows that it really does take a certain amount of time to get ready in the morning. You can't just show up, you know, the moment school starts. So not earlier than half an hour, and then leaving at the end of the day not later than half an hour after school is dismissed. And not attending staff meetings on those days and not doing any unnecessary activities or activities that are not strictly prescribed in our job description. So that's McGinty Mondays, and we are...
Have you stuck around yourself mm-hmm. at the end of McGinty Mondays to see what the school looks like after everyone's left?
Yeah, actually, I have been, partly so that I can round people up and make sure they're leaving. and it's an interesting thing. I mean, when everybody leaves quickly after school, the school becomes a very quiet place. And it gives you a sense of how much work we normally do after school hours, because when things are working as normal and there are sports teams and clubs and you know, kids hanging around after school, you do get a sense of how long the day is beyond the regular teaching day. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a very different place, for sure. We are extending our McGinty Mondays onto Tuesdays also starting this week, so we'll have that kind of thing happening Mondays and Tuesdays.
You should call them McTuesdays.
Yeah, we were trying to think of a tea thing.
What?
Dalton Tuesdays.
Dalton Tuesdays, yeah.
Yeah, McGinty Mondays and Dalton Tuesdays. That actually works pretty well. We might want to
go
with that one. Very nice.
Copyright.
Yes. And then you did mention the November 7th deadline for strike action. And, in fact, that is OSSTF, which is the secondary teachers. And so what they have said is that they are going to withdraw from some activities, not attend staff meetings, departmental meetings, not to communicate with parents outside of the regular school day, or participate in activities involved in standardized tests. So I think that's going to be an interesting
and parent-teacher interviews too.
Well, what they will have to do, I think, is hold them during the regular school day. And this is secondary. So elementary is a little bit behind in terms of being in a legal strike position. We need to wait 2 weeks after our conciliator and our no board report. So that might put us about a week later than secondary. So what we normally do with parent-teacher interviews is that we do interview in the evening because most parents, or many parents, are not available during the day. We get a PA day for interviews, but because many parents are not available, we do interview in the evening. So what it sounds like secondary will do is not do those evening interviews but be available just during the day, which of course makes it not very good for all of those parents who are not available during the day. But again, there's nothing that says that we have to interview in the evening. I mean, my job doesn't actually go till 9 o'clock at night, so if I want to leave at the end of the school day, I can.
And you're saying that the elementary union is slightly behind, so do you anticipate then job action following or job action announcement following?
I do, yes, I do anticipate that. I think it'd probably go along the same lines as OSSTF. Because the report cards are coming out before that, our parent-teacher interviews will probably not be affected, but I imagine then we will have a directive from the union as to exactly what we will do.
But if you're already working to rule and you don't need to be at school past a certain time, what's stopping you from taking the same action before a call like that?
Any teacher can just do their job at any point in time because that's their job and they don't have to coach teams or anything like that. And we've got the McGinty Mondays and Tuesdays going on now. My sense is that it's not uniform all across the province at this point in time. There are still some teachers who are doing extracurricular or who are, you know, attending all kinds of meetings and doing what they normally do. And the directive, well, the advice we've
get suggestions.
Got, yeah, suggestions yeah. we've received from the union are just suggestions. Mm-hmm. But when we're in a legal strike position, then it will become a directive and teachers will be required to follow the union directive.
And in the memo with the suggestions, it's noted that first that they're suggestions, but also that in the case where, as a teacher, you are implementing some of these suggestions and you get pushback from the administration, that you should go to the union steward and advise the administration that I'm going to have to go talk to my union.
Yeah.
How much? So how busy have you been since then?
I feel like at this point in my school, we have actually had a pretty good relationship with the administration. And it's interesting to note that all of the cuts and all of the implications of Bill 115 will, in fact, impact the administration in the same way that they impact the teachers. So Bill 115 actually covers all education workers, including principals and vice principals. So it kind of varies from school to school. In my school, I feel quite comfortable going to the principal and saying, okay, so this is what we're doing. And she so far has been very accommodating, and so there haven't been that many skirmishes. I certainly have heard from other schools where there have been, where the principals are really resistant, and then the union steward has to go to the union executive, and you know, at that point, an executive member would come into the school and speak to the principal, and if it doesn't get resolved at that level, then they will grieve it. They will launch a grievance. So I think there will be a lot of grievances through this procedure, and grievances take a long time to resolve, so I'm not sure, you know, we won't see the resolution of those immediately. I think as we come up to the progress reports, then it will be probably... it'll a little bit come to a head because that's an area where there will be disagreement, certainly between administration and teachers. And also then parents will start coming to administrators, and I think when the parents start coming to administrators, then they feel pressure from a number of different directions. The progress reports for elementary come out the second week of November, and what the union has advised us to do is be fairly minimal in our comments. Their advice is based on the growing success document, which comes from the Ministry of Education, and it is not, the advice that they've given is not, it doesn't contradict anything in the document. We used to have three report cards during a school year with marks and comments, and then a couple of years ago they decided they would have two reporting terms, but in the fall there would be this progress report card. And initially the idea was that it was a checklist of progressing well or very well or with difficulty. And in the TDSB, and perhaps some other boards, but I think in particular in the TDSB, it became this huge, huge document with lots of comments and individual learning skills and take a long time to prepare. What the union is doing is basically advising teachers just to do the minimum that's required, so not to go against the requirements of it in any way, but also not to make it a bigger thing than it was meant to be. So they did put out an advisory saying, actually, all you need to do is, you know, one comment in this box and one comment in this box. So some principals are accepting of that, and some principals are not. And so the ones who are not are going to, I think, then come up against some union concerns.
It sounds like no matter how, what the ultimate outcome of this conflict is, that there's going to be residual effects within individual schools after the fact between the administration and teachers. Is there any way that unions are, your union is preparing for that?
Well, certainly the union does have contact with the Principals Association and with the trustees and with the superintendents, and tries to be on a good relationship with them. You know, some people are easier to work with than others, and as teachers in the school, I think we do always try to build strong relationships with our administrators, because we know that a school functions well if everybody's on the same page. I think it's interesting that there are some school boards where the trustees have come out in favor of the union advisories. For example, there's a board, I think it's in Niagara, where the trustees have actually put forward a motion calling for the repeal of Bill 115. And so one of the things that the union does is really try to communicate information to all of the other parties, administrators, trustees, and that kind of thing, to try to get them on side, so we're all on the same page. You know, I mean, we always are trying to work with the administrators in the school and get them to work together.
So one benefit in some ways to such a pushback on behalf of the government is an increase in solidarity amongst membership.
Yeah.
And you mentioned a pushback against standardized testing as part of the job action plan for November.
Yeah.
Do you foresee or hope for any kind of general advancement in progressive education agenda coming out of the pushback against this specific bill? Or do you think it'll be limited to this particular action?
Yeah, I actually have great hopes for that. I think there's a definite movement within the union. Teachers, and in particular teachers who are parents who have kids in the public system, fighting against standardized testing. I have a son who's in grade six, for example, and there is that's an EQAO year, and he's not going to write the EQAO, and I think that there's a growing movement of teachers who have children in the grade 3 and 6 years to have them not write the test, and I think we are really trying to educate parents and teachers about the fact that the test is actually not strictly speaking mandatory. they will tell you it is, but you can withdraw your child from it. And I would really encourage other parents who have children in those years to speak to the teacher, speak to the school, and see what they can do about that. I mean, you can always just keep your child at home. You should be able to send your child to school and have them not write the test. But I think it's a big education piece that we need to think about what is good educational practice. And I think it's becoming quite clear that standardized testing is not. And so, you know, I think, again, this is one of these opportunities that we can look at what makes our public education good. And we do have good public education, and we need to think about where we're going and really try to mobilize teachers and parents to make changes to the system that will benefit the students.
So what are some resources that people can go to now for more education on the issues and information on how they can get involved?
Right. We have really great information on the union websites. So OSSTF is the Secondary School Teachers Union, and ETFO is the Elementary School Teachers Union. And they both have a lot of the documents that we've been speaking about and information for parents and for other general public who are really interested. So those would be great places to go.
You can actually read the memo that teachers were given.
Yes.
And see exactly how it was described to them, what they are suggested to do.
Yeah, and I think the unions have been really transparent on this. All of the information that we as teachers are getting, all of that information is posted on the website, so people can check it out and see exactly what it is. There's also information for writing to your MPPs, and I think that's a really great way to be involved, and it has all the addresses and everything on those websites. You can certainly do that. There are various petitions going around to repeal Bill 115, and I would encourage people to check those out and hopefully sign them. And then also to be involved in some of our political actions, that we are picketing MPP's offices every Friday afternoon after school. So, you know, if you're in Toronto, you can find the addresses either on the union websites or obviously on the provincial government website. And different offices are targeted different Fridays, but there is a picket at every office every Friday. Some of them are bigger, depending if it's a targeted one or not. But those are really great things that people can do to be involved.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for taking the time. We really appreciate it. I should note that we've been at a cafe, in the Rustic Owl, so you've been hearing some ambient noise in the background. We've been talking to Laura McCoy, and Jim and I have been, on After the Collapse on Radio Regent, a show dedicated to investigating the link between economic exploitation and social injustice. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
In the coming months. This is, I think, a big issue, not just for teachers, but for the province and the country.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Jim?
Thank you.
All right.